From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And today, Representative Justin Amash, the Republican of Michigan, became possibly the first Republican to publicly use the I word. The Hill reports that Amash said reports that President Trump asked FBI Director James Comey to just let go of the Russia investigation would merit impeachment if true. And today, Democrats in Congress, led by Representative Joe Crowley, signed a discharge petition hoping to force a vote that would set up an independent commission to investigate Russian interference in the U.S. election and possible ties to the Trump campaign. But House Speaker Paul Ryan said Congress should be sober and follow the facts wherever they may lead. Here he is at a press conference this morning.
Look, there's been a lot of reporting lately. I think that requires close examination. Let me tell you what I told our members just this morning. We need the facts. It is obvious there are some people out there who want to harm the president, but we have an obligation to carry out our oversight regardless of which party is in the White House. And that means before rushing to judgment, we get all the pertinent information.
Let's bring in NPR congressional reporter Jeff Bennett. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Robin.
And of course, all of this reaction today is to the report that James Comey memorialized his meetings with President Trump and others. He was known to have put everything in memo form. And that after a dinner with President Trump, the day after Michael Flynn, his former intelligence security advisor, was fired, that President Trump asked James Comey to please let go of any investigation, saying that Michael Flynn was a good guy. Let it go. What else are you hearing in Washington today about this?
And we should say the White House points out that the New York Times portrayal of that conversation, they say, is not truthful or accurate.
Right.
But, you know, Robin, Democrats are really pouncing on this as evidence that the president tried to directly influence an active Justice Department and FBI investigation. There were some Democrats, like Congressman Al Green of Texas, who on the House floor today called for an impeachment. He said that the Comey memo could amount to obstruction of justice by the White House. But Democratic leadership, by and large, folks like Steny Hoyer, Joe Crowley, Elijah Cummings, they're all staying away from impeachment talk. They say they need to take a slower and more deliberative approach. But I think the biggest shift here is that late yesterday, Congressman Jason Chaffetz, he's the Republican chairman of the House Oversight Committee, he wrote a letter demanding that the FBI turn over all the memos, notes, any recordings of the discussions between President Trump and Comey. Those documents could come very soon. Speaker Paul Ryan made very clear this morning that he supports that. And if those documents don't come, Chaffetz tweeted that he has his subpoena pen ready. But by and large, Republicans that we spoke with this morning were not really willing to speak on the record until they get more information. The House Republicans gathered this morning for their weekly meeting. We waited out front to speak with them as we routinely do. We got a lot of no comments. Some, you know, pretended to talk on their cell phones as they walked back to the Capitol so as to avoid being questioned. But one congressman, Jim Comer of Kentucky, did choose to engage us for a bit. And he represents a district that voted for Trump in the 2016 election. And he says that his constituents think that the president is getting a raw deal from the press and from establishment Republicans. And Comer said something you hear a lot of Trump supporters say, and that's that President Trump is misunderstood, and a lot of what he says tends to get lost in translation. Here he is.
I think a lot of times he's the victim of not being a career politician, not knowing that sometimes when you say a joke, and everybody knows it's a joke, but when it's written in print, it doesn't sound like a joke.
So what he was speaking there was of a time when President Trump joked with Freedom Caucus Chairman Mark Meadows in a conference and said, you know, I'm going to come after you, because at the time, Meadows didn't support the White House-backed health care bill. And Comer said it read in print media as if it was decidedly worse than it actually was. And so you heard a lot of Republicans like Louie Gohmert, Jim Comer, make that point that the people they represent aren't willing to break with this president just yet.
Well, don't others also have a point that at this point, we should see and hear what those conversations were? I mean, we should tell people who haven't read it that the memo that James Comey kept or claims to have kept, you know, the contents of it were, you know, delivered to reporters by other people who had seen it. You know, what is the next shoe that will possibly drop? Do you think we will see these memos? Do you think we'll hear from Comey?
Well, I do think we'll hear from Comey. He, as I understand it, wanted to testify publicly about all this. Senator Lindsey Graham, who oversees one of the four committees looking into the Russia connection, has invited him or says that he's welcome to come and testify publicly. You know, there are four congressional investigations into Russia's interference and the possible ties between the Trump campaign and Russian officials. There's the House Intelligence Committee, the Senate Intelligence Committee, the House Oversight Committee, the Senate Judiciary Committee. There's no question among the Democrats that I've spoken with that all of this gives them new momentum in trying to establish an outside independent probe. They say the atmosphere is too politicized and that the American public, as a result of everything that has transpired, won't trust the findings of one of the standing congressional committees. And, you know, folks like Nancy Pelosi, they've been pushing for months to create an independent bipartisan panel to lead this investigation.
Well, we mentioned that today Democrats introduced a discharge petition to accelerate those congressional investigations into possible ties between Russia and Trump associates. Here's Democratic Congressman Elijah Cummings.
This is about the soul of our democracy. I keep saying that. First of all, there was an issue, a question of impeachment. I agree with Adam Schiff. I'm not there. I just want to get the information.
Yeah. Jeff Bennett, one last question. We know the president preparing for his first trip abroad as president, scheduled to visit Saudi Arabia and Israel before heading to a NATO meeting in Brussels. Will that take this away, or is this just consuming Washington right now?
It could. You know, I do think it's consuming Washington. The Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, who doesn't say much about President Trump, he said the other day, you know, I think we could do with a little less drama from the White House on a lot of things, speaking about the distraction that it's creating here on Capitol Hill. But there's no doubt that all of this has really strained the credibility of Trump aides, of his press office, and of the president himself.
Yeah. NPR congressional reporter Jeff Bennett, thank you.
Sure thing.
Well, a primary held last night in Philadelphia is offering hope to progressives. By a large margin, a longtime civil rights attorney won a seven-way race to become the city's next district attorney. Larry Krasner campaigned on a super progressive platform, promising to turn the criminal justice system on its head. And his victory means an anti-establishment candidate who spent his career fighting against prosecutors will soon lead one of the busiest DA offices in the country. Bobby Allen from Here and Now contributor WHYY reports.
Talking in a courtyard crammed with supporters, Larry Krasner acknowledged the odds he overcame.
We were told it was political suicide to say, I will never seek the death penalty.
Yeah!
Does that look like political suicide right now?
No!
Krasner later told reporters how he wants shorter prison terms for convicted criminals.
Where there is unnecessary incarceration, it necessarily destroys schools. And it destroys rehabilitation of people of the medical condition of addiction. And it destroys individuals, families, and neighborhoods.
With that in-your-face progressive message, Krasner beat out five former prosecutors and a former judge. He's never held office and pitched his outsider status and radically different approach to public safety as key attributes. Krasner wants to end cash bail. He's against the death penalty. He wants fewer people stopped and frisked. And he's bragged about all the cops he's sued over the years.
I have filed 75 civil rights lawsuits in the last 25 years against police for corruption and for physical abuse. I have pursued those cases vigorously, even though it's not the most lucrative thing and doesn't make you especially popular.
It's a message that spoke to C.R. Robinson. Robinson's dad has been incarcerated for decades. He alleges there was prosecutorial misconduct. That has always colored his view of the criminal justice system, and in turn, boosted Robinson's support for Krasner.
Well, he's a DA that's not looking to lock up and throw away the key. He's looking to prevent people from going to prison and keep people out of prison. So for me, he's the people's DA.
Another current in the race, the Trump factor. That's what brought out Michael O'Neill to the polls. He usually doesn't pay attention to local races, but the outcome of the presidential election delivered a jolt. Part of Krasner's platform was to resist the Trump agenda. That message gained a wider audience with the help of a $1.4 million infusion into a political action committee backing Krasner and paid for by billionaire George Soros. However it reached O'Neill, the pitch appealed to him.
The people who were disappointed in the presidential election are able to push back a little bit in this certain way and push back in a way that you know, sends a message to the state and to the federal level that if we can make things happen at the local level, perhaps next time around we can make things happen at the bigger scale.
Joseph Schwartz studies elections at Temple University, where he's a professor of political science. Schwartz says Krasner's victory could change how DA races are run in other cities dominated by Democrats.
They begin to realize that running hard on law and order is no longer the traditional way to be a viable candidate. I think this may have a profound influence on restraining aggressive district attorneys.
Philadelphia is a one-party city, and yesterday's primary is seen as a de facto victory for Democrats. So that means Krasner, who used to represent people allegedly brutalized by police and members of Black Lives Matter, will soon have to represent crime victims and work with police officers he spent his career suing. Some insiders say that transition might be a little rocky. For Here and Now, I'm Bobby Allen in Philadelphia.
You're listening to Here and Now.
In the course of our lives, we all experience failure, but when it's a space shuttle mission, the consequences can be fatal.
Our job is to keep the crew safe, and they weren't safe, and that's an immediate failure. Now you're just asking, in what way did we fail?
I'm Ari Shapiro. An investigation into the nature of failure, starting this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This Saturday, the new film The Wizard of Lies premieres on HBO. It tells the story of the downfall of financier Bernie Madoff, whose Ponzi scheme cost investors tens of billions of dollars when it collapsed in December of 2008. It's based on the book of the same name by New York Times financial reporter Diana Henriquez. She was the first reporter to interview Madoff in prison, and some of those conversations are portrayed in the movie. Diana Henriquez joins us now. Good to talk to you again.
Oh, it's a delight to be here, Jeremy.
Well, and as we said, you were the first reporter to talk to Bernie Madoff on the record after he went to prison. Did you get a sense, or do you have more of a sense now, of why he did it?
At the time, it was very hard to put any whys to it. Madoff had a bit of a cover story, which was that, you know, he had always been an honest investment manager, and then he just fell behind because big investors were taking out more money than they should, and he could just never get back on the right side of the law again. I don't think I fully believed that then. And having corresponded with him in the years since then, I'm far more convinced that it's a more complex explanation, Jeremy. I think this is a man who just was incapable of admitting failure at anything. And if the market let him look like a genius money manager, honestly, great. But if he couldn't look like a genius honestly, he'd look like a genius dishonestly.
Does he know this movie is coming out?
He does. He follows the news about himself fairly carefully. It won't surprise you knowing what a narcissist he is. And so he was aware that HBO had optioned the book when it came out. I spoke with him a few times during production to clarify some points. I mean, where the script was relying on my book exactly, you know, I was at peace with that because I can back it up in the footnotes. But where the script wanted to add something, I would research it and be sure I was comfortable verifying it. At a few points, that involved checking things with Madoff. So he was aware that the production had begun. You know, how he feels about it, he's never said. I don't imagine he's displeased that one of the greatest actors of our time is playing him.
Robert De Niro.
Yes, but I don't think he'll have a chance to see it. I mean, the Bureau of Prisons usually doesn't carry premium cable channels, so.
Well, let's listen to a scene from early in the film. This is Bernie Madoff, played by De Niro, telling his family that his company is built on a Ponzi scheme to the utter disbelief, it appears, of his sons and his wife.
It's a fraud. There are no investments.
What are you talking about? Of course they're investments.
I made them up.
They're on every statement.
I made them up.
I've seen the trades.
They're fake. All fake. Basically just a big Ponzi scheme.
What's a Ponzi scheme?
I took money from some people and I gave it to others and I never, there's nothing left. It's supposed to be $50 billion. There's absolutely nothing. It's all gone.
Do you buy, this is something that I've had a problem with since the very beginning of this, and obviously this film gets into this, do you buy that the family didn't know anything?
I think there's absolutely no evidence that they did know anything. It was among the conclusions of my book when it was originally published, Jeremy, that there was abundant circumstantial evidence exonerating Ruth and Madoff's two sons and zero evidence implicating them. What we do know now, and particularly after evidence presented in the criminal trials for Madoff employees that came several years after my book was complete, we know that the government believes this fraud began as early as 1978. I'm not sure that I buy that. I think it's possible Bernie stepped across the line and back again and across the line and back again several times. But I'm absolutely confident that this Ponzi scheme was up and running at least by the mid-1980s. Well, at that point, his sons are still in college or in high school. So they get out of school, they come to work in the family firm, and how does that conversation go? Oh, by the way, Mark, Andy, guess what we're doing downstairs on the 17th floor? And these two young men out of the Wharton School, University of Michigan, decide that rather than go work someplace else on Wall Street, they're going to stay there and work with Dad until the Ponzi scheme falls apart. It never made any intellectual sense. It never made any emotional sense. And Ruth always suspected, although not with any proof, that Bernie was cheating on her, that he was, you know, so much more attractive to other women that he must be cheating on her. Well, who's even going to let his wife suspect that if she can drop a dime on him to the FBI? Mm. So when you look at those circumstances, in addition to lots of down-in-the-weeds stuff about how they handled their money, their behavior during several of his cash crises, when if they had been his accomplices, they certainly would not have been withdrawing money the way they did. And I reached the conclusion in my original book that they were innocent of any knowledge of the Ponzi scheme until Madoff confessed to them. And the film is faithful to that conclusion.
And we should say, for people who haven't followed this story, that Bernie Madoff's son Andy has died of cancer. His son Mark killed himself after what happened.
Yes, he committed suicide on the second anniversary of his father's arrest.
The authorities also did not catch on to what he was doing. In fact, they caught him because his sons called the FBI. How did the authorities not have any clue that this was a fraud?
Well, more than anything else, Jeremy, it was a massive failure of imagination. They simply could not imagine that this man that they had respected and admired, one of the most innovative pioneers on Wall Street, you know, an advisor on industry roundtables, they couldn't imagine that he would be running a Ponzi scheme, in part because, frankly, they had the same delusions about Ponzi schemers that many of us still have, you know, that they're going to be these big, bon vivant, charismatic characters promising pie in the sky and double your money in 50 days. They thought that was a Ponzi scheme, and that was definitely not Bernie Madoff. The few times that they investigated him, they investigated him for a completely different crime, a form of insider trading called front-running, which he was in a perfect position to do. His wholesale trading firm handled an enormous volume of orders from all the biggest firms, mutual funds, and discount brokers on the street. So Bernie could see a queue of orders for, say, General Electric coming in. Well, what would be easier? He puts a little private order in for his private clients at the beginning of that queue, and then all those big institutional orders drive up the price of General Electric, and he quietly sells. So he could almost engineer a profit for himself by front-running. Unfortunately, it's illegal. And that's what the few people who suspected Bernie thought he was doing. They thought he was front-running, and of course, Bernie loved it when they investigated him for front-running because it was the one crime he wasn't committing. And so every time they investigated him for front-running, what happened? He came up with a clean bill of health. So it was a tragedy of errors, really.
Let's listen to one more clip from the film in which you appear as yourself. And in this scene, you're asking Madoff, played by De Niro, if he really knew what he was getting his family into.
You say you wanted to protect your family.
Right.
But just an example, what would have happened if at some point before the crisis of 08, you'd been hit by a bus, you'd dropped dead? Mark and Andrew would have become the owners of a firm that was still in the middle of perpetrating the biggest Ponzi scheme in history.
Except the advisory was a completely separate business, one in which they had no involvement, so...
But with you dead, and Frank probably willing to swear to anything to save himself, seems to me the odds are that his owners and lifelong executives, they'd have gone to jail. Your sons would be sitting there where you are.
What was it like to sit opposite Robert De Niro playing Bernie Madoff as opposed to sitting opposite the real Bernie Madoff?
Not much different, Jeremy. Jeremy, it was really
could you tell the difference?
A little supernatural how close they were. Yes, of course. I mean, there are some facial feature differences that you can see. A very, very slight difference in the voice. I think Bob got Bernie's voice almost dead nuts on. And he's sitting right across the table from me in this replica of the prison visiting room that they've built, holding his hands and moving his shoulders and talking and acting. It was like reliving those visits to the prison. I had to audition to play myself.
Really?
Enough. Oh, yes. That was a surreal experience. I figured if I flunked my screen test, I'd go directly to a shrink, to see why I couldn't give a convincing portrayal of myself. But in the audition, I did the first reading with the casting director and then was called back to read the scene with De Niro. So, he didn't have the script letter perfect yet, but we sat knee to knee on a couple of plastic chairs in the casting director's office. And I think I had the first lines, and I said my lines. I asked him a question, and he had a one or two word answer. Asked him again. And as he was answering, maybe 40 seconds, if that, into this scene, I could just see him change. I mean, the way he held his mouth, the way he held his head. And then later, I could see that those were the little bits he was starting to put together that would become this incredible portrayal. But I can't tell you what a fascinating experience it was as a journalist to have a front row seat at watching this incredible actor build this role and carry it out. It was just remarkable.
That's New York Times financial reporter Diana Henriquez, who is the author of the book The Wizard of Lies, which is the basis for the new HBO film, which premieres this Saturday. Diana, thanks as always.
Always happy to be with you, Jeremy.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Relationships are important. Cooking together builds strong family bonds, and Blue Apron makes cooking together fun and easy. Research shows that Blue Apron families cook nearly 3 times more often. So join in, get the family together, and choose your meals each week. They come to your door with pre-measured ingredients so you can spend time with your family and not at the grocery store. With the simple instructions, everyone can help prepare the meal. There's no risk. Get your first 3 meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/here.
This week, the Trump administration announced it's significantly expanding the Mexico City policy, which prohibits American aid from going to foreign NGOs that perform or promote abortions. It was named after the city in which it was announced during a convention on population. Every Republican president since Ronald Reagan has put the policy in place. Every Democratic president has rescinded it. So what will happen under the new expansion? Ike Swetlitz is a reporter with our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Ike, what has this policy traditionally been?
Usually the Mexico City policy prevents family planning funding from going to any organizations that support or promote or perform abortions. And under the Trump administration, they're expanding that to include all global health funding. So funding for malaria or just sexual health education or something like that can't go to an organization that is promoting or performing abortions, even in countries where abortions are legal or accepted.
And we should say that when you say promoting, what does that mean? I mean, there are certainly not advertising, you know, abortions are great, but they might even be telling a patient that there is another organization that offers it?
So that's a little bit of a fuzzy line, and it's up to inspectors who sort of stop by every so often at these organizations to clarify that. but providing fact sheets or maybe lobbying the government for more expansive abortion access, doing public outreach or education campaigns are some of the things that might fall under this.
And how much of an expansion are we talking about in dollars?
Under the previous policies, something like $500-600 million was at stake. That was the family planning funding. Now, according to the State Department, we're looking at about $8.8 billion, which is a lot more.
Yeah, 15 times more, you write, than the Mexico City policy as enacted under President George W. Bush. Look, critics of this have said you will end up spending more on unintended pregnancies and illnesses. What countries are going to be most affected?
The countries that are going to be most affected are ones where people might not know about their options, and some of this education is more necessary. I actually, for a totally different story, was in Burkina Faso a number of months ago and was talking to some sexual health workers there who were saying that even though there are many cases in which abortions are allowed, people don't know about it, and it's necessary for the health workers to do that education. Otherwise, people might turn to other more dangerous methods of trying to perform an abortion on their own.
We'll talk about that, because there have traditionally been exceptions under the Mexico City policy. Will the policy under the Trump administration have exemptions for abortions that are done in response to rape or incest or life-threatening conditions? And rape, in particular, in war zones where rape is an act of war. I mean, will those women still be allowed to be told about or receive abortion services?
There are some exceptions carved out in this policy, and that's one of them. If someone is referred for an abortion in the case of rape, incest, or a threat to the life of the mother, that's allowed.
You write that other countries have tried to pitch in. There was at least a $190 million commitment at a conference in Brussels, but that does nothing to make a dent in the $8.8 billion that's going to be lost.
Yeah, and we're still waiting to see sort of how and where that money is being distributed. I think that that was also just sort of a show of support from these other European countries for some of these international organizations that might be receiving less support now from the United States.
Ike Sweatlitz, a reporter with our partners at STAT. Ike, thanks as always.
Thank you.
The FCC is voting tomorrow on a proposal to start rolling back President Obama's rules on net neutrality. Those rules prevent internet service providers from creating so-called fast lanes, favoring certain content. HBO's John Oliver recently defended net neutrality on his show Last Week Tonight.
It also helps ensure a level playing field so that big companies cannot undermine small companies before they can take off. And without it, Ancestry.com could easily crush my new site, Just Tell Me If I'm Related to a Nazi.com.
Well, today we're going to hear another point of view. Harold Furchgott Roth is the director at the Center for the Economics of the Internet at the Hudson Institute and a former Republican commissioner of the FCC. Welcome.
It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
And you've written in the past that net neutrality violates the First Amendment and free speech. Explain what you mean.
The speakers, whether they're on broadcast television or your local street corner or on the internet, should have opportunities to express themselves and not have the government say what they can or cannot say. And folks on the internet are very much like this, and they too have First Amendment protections. The network neutrality rules that are currently in place limit the ability of these speakers to exercise control of blocking potentially offensive material or providing preferable treatment to speakers that they might like.
Don't net neutrality rules, though, keep companies from providing preferential treatment to speakers that they might like?
Yes, they prohibit a company from preferring speech that they like and prohibit them from blocking speech that they may not like.
And you believe that's unfair?
It's not a question of unfair. I think it's unconstitutional. And I also happen to think it's quite unfair as well. If I'm a broadband provider and for whatever reason I decide I don't like ISIS, and I want to block ISIS websites, and I'm prohibited from doing that by FCC rules.
Now, one of the arguments in favor of net neutrality is that it helps startups. Hundreds of tech companies and startups sent a letter to FCC Chair Ajit Pai saying weakening net neutrality rules would allow internet service providers to impede traffic from our services to favor their own services. Do you worry about that?
if you follow the money, if you look at where most of the money coming for the opposition, or actually the support for network neutralities, it's not from small companies of the type you're just describing. It's from four of the five largest corporations in the world. The internet has been around for approximately 25 to 27 years in a commercial format. Literally hundreds of thousands, if not millions of companies in the United States got started in an environment where there were no network neutrality rules. These rules have only been in place for approximately 18 months.
But wouldn't you be giving even more power to these big companies that you're talking about, including Comcast and Verizon, by getting rid of net neutrality rules?
The companies you mentioned are much smaller than the companies that are supporting network neutrality rules.
You're talking about which companies?
I'm talking about Google, Facebook, Amazon, large corporations that are much larger than the companies you just mentioned.
Well, Verizon and Comcast are pretty big companies, though, don't you think?
Not as big as the four largest corporations in America, no.
How do you think that ordinary consumers would be affected if net neutrality rules were to go away?
Not at all.
Not at all?
I don't think they would notice it at all.
Hmm.
I'll ask your audience, have you noticed any change in the internet in the past 18 months? I think most Americans would say no. Having network neutrality rules has not had a dramatic effect on the ordinary consumer. What it has had an effect on is investment by corporations seeking to be broadband internet providers. As an example, I know of an Israeli company that has a wonderful type of software to block out various types of pornography, various types of content that parents might not want their children to be exposed to. That type of software would be illegal for a broadband internet service provider to have on their system under the network neutrality rules because it would block certain content.
So why do you think that somebody like John Oliver, the late night host, has had such success galvanizing people to write in and try to stop any change in net neutrality rules?
Look, I am not an expert on late night television or on comedy on television. It's obviously been very successful, but I think it really undermines the seriousness, if you will, of the comments that the commission receives when they are so heavily swayed by a late night entertainment host who can simply say, you know, why don't you send in something to this website and we'll do something with it.
That's former FCC Commissioner Harold Furchtgott Roth, who is the director at the Center for the Economics of the Internet at the Hudson Institute. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, over the last week, it seems like the top story every day has been the latest revelations about the Trump White House. But if you turned on Fox News yesterday morning, you may have heard a different story about a man named Seth Rich.
The DNC staffer who was gunned down on July 10th on Washington, D.C. street last July, just steps from his home, had leaked thousands of internal email to WikiLeaks, law enforcement sources have told Fox News. So it looks
like right-wing media outlets have been floating theories for months that Rich was the person who provided WikiLeaks with DNC emails and that his death was connected to that. The police department in Washington, D.C. says Rich may have been the victim of a robbery. And earlier this week, a private investigator and Fox News contributor named Rod Wheeler said evidence existed that proved Rich had been in contact with WikiLeaks before his death. But by yesterday afternoon, that story fell apart. Let's turn now to NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. And David, tell us what happened yesterday in the Seth Rich story.
So Rod Wheeler, this private investigator who's presented by Fox 5 in Washington and by Fox News as being an investigator on behalf of the family, said, you know, there is evidence that is showing, proving the leak between the killed DNC aide and WikiLeaks. But by the end of the day, he said, no, I heard that from the reporter for Fox. I didn't know that myself. And the family said there's no ties that they've ever seen and pointed out that, in fact, that this investigator, Rod Wheeler, has been paid by a third party. And NBC News disclosed, I mean, it's a fascinating story with twists. NBC News disclosed that that third party actually is a Fox News contributor based in Texas, who also is a writer for Breitbart News. And so you see that there's a certain kind of ideological component to this seemingly charitable investigation of this young man's death.
And Fox News was playing this up big time yesterday. It was the top story on their website. And it seemed like there was sort of a wink-wink going along with it. Hillary Clinton may have been involved in the death.
Well, gosh, it certainly does echoes of the whole, controversies and ludicrous and harmful conspiracy theories ginned up about the pizza parlor in Washington, D.C. Or echoes of the 1990s when people claimed that Clinton had ties to the death of their friend and former White House aide Vince Foster and other people who had died in Arkansas, claims for which there was no evidence ever.
It also brings up a question of whether Fox News on a daily basis, not just with this story, is picking stories to focus on that don't hurt President Trump. When scandals come up at the White House, they're talking about other things.
Well, they're either talking about other things or, by and large, with some exceptions, playing extraordinary defense for Trump by trying to point the finger at Jim Comey. You had Tucker Carlson, very much an anti-Trumper and sometimes cheerful Trump ally, spending an entire segment kind of hectoring a New York City councilman over the state of the men's rooms at Penn Station here in New York City. Hmm. You had people on Fox and Friends suggesting perhaps Jim Comey committed a crime by keeping a diary in which he had a memo to file saying, Trump asked me to essentially cut off the investigation of his presumed NSA advisor, Michael Flynn. You had a number of other segments. Bill Hemmer, a potentially non-ideological anchor who came over to Fox from CNN, really tetchily and I thought ungraciously contradicting almost everything out of the mouth of one of his liberal guests who were trying to, indicate the reason why the Trump White House is in this crisis and why not just Democrats but others might take issue with some of the actions there.
That's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thank you so much.
You bet.
The Syrian government is denying U.S. allegations of mass killings at a prison near Damascus, in which as many as 50 detainees are hanged every day and then burned in a crematorium in a cover-up. Syria's foreign ministry calls the claim a new Hollywood plot and notes a U.S. record of false claims to justify war. The allegations come as President Trump considers U.S. options in Syria. He launched missile strikes on a government airbase last month after accusing President Bashar al-Assad of using chemical weapons to kill scores of civilians. We saw those horrible images of people poisoned and gassed. Is it possible there's a crematorium now? Jeremy Boehm is the BBC's Middle East editor. He joins us from London. And Jeremy, to those claims of mass killings at a prison, bodies burned, what proof does the U.S. have? We know there are some aerial photos. Are they definitive?
No, I think there isn't any convincing proof right now. There are some aerial pictures, and essentially we just have the word of the guys who spoke about it. I have to say that, and I don't have proof either way, I was a bit skeptical when I heard the report. I thought, why are they bringing it out now? What's happening in Syrian prisons is monstrous by all accounts. There's a lot of evidence that many people have been killed. But to suggest there's almost like some kind of a Nazi-style operation going on there sounds to me to be, well, I mean, it may be true, but it sounds to me to be a little alarmist, perhaps, because the fact is they've killed many, many people in Syria, and they haven't felt the need to build special crematoria to put them in, or indeed to particularly cover up what they're doing. And if you look at the numbers involved, if they're talking about 50 dead or more or less than that, if you go back to the Second World War, in Auschwitz-Birkenau, at the height of the Holocaust, they were killing 6,000 people there a day. Mm. And they had an industrialized form of murder there. Are we suggesting the Syrians are doing something similar? I'm not sure they are.
Well, when you say why now, we are in the middle of peace talks. There was some speculation that if these mass killings are true, it could be that Assad is rushing to get rid of evidence of hanging prisoners as the peace talks are held in anticipation of perhaps something coming of these peace talks. But we're hearing that the accusations themselves have really cast a shadow over the talks. What is your sense? It's the sixth round of negotiations. What is your sense that something might come out of these talks?
My sense is don't hold your breath.
Yeah.
I think that Assad is determined to stay in power. That's something which the last 6 years have told us. He's got some very powerful friends, the Russians, the Iranians, Hezbollah in Lebanon. The attack by the US, the Tomahawk attack after the latest chemical weapons incident, I think was something that was a setback, no doubt, for Assad. And it was a wake-up call as well, because I think they'd written off the American desire to take any kind of military action, certainly in the Obama years. So I think he'd be looking at Trump with more warily, you might say. But I don't anticipate any progress leading to some kind of settlement in these talks. If I had to bet on it, I'd say that there were years left in this war.
Yeah. I just want to ask you again about these aerial photographs. They show that starting in 2013, there was some kind of construction involving cement and such, and things that looked to observers like it could have been the elements of a crematorium. Again, there's nothing really more than that. When you say, why bring it up now, what other concerns would there be to pointing out something that may be happening and is horrendous?
Yeah, I mean, if it's true, it's absolutely horrendous. If they're killing the people at the rate that has been reported, and that it's been on quite good authority that many people have been killed in this prison, then it is absolutely horrendous. It's what has been happening in Syria for the last, since 2011, is the most, you know, I've spent a lot of time there. It's absolutely barbaric. The suffering of the people is really, really, really awful. However, you know, it's a prison. They build things with concrete. They build things with cement. Do we know it's not an incinerator? I'm not trying to defend the Assad administration here. What I'm trying to simply say is that the U.S. has not come up with definitive proof. Yeah. I would very much like to see it if they've got it.
And by the way, you've been with the BBC for 32 years and a foreign correspondent for about 30 of those. And with everything you've seen, where would you place Syria?
Oh, I think it's one of the most awful things. You know, a lot of my career has been spent in war zones, in areas of conflict. I've seen a lot of terrible things over many, many years. The Rwandan genocide, all the trouble in the Middle East, wars in Chechnya, wars in the civil war in Algeria, Afghanistan, Iraq. I mean, you name it, 20 wars or something. And what has happened in Syria is right up there with the worst of any of that. I think there's no doubt about it.
Yeah. Well, Jeremy Bowen, we look forward to continued reporting. The BBC's Middle East editor in London. Jeremy, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.